From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The event known as the Wilmington Riot of 1898 is considered by many scholars to be a turning point in North Carolina's political history. On November 10, 1898, as many as 100 black people were killed, many others forced out of town, because a group of white political and business leaders first stole an election and then, not content with the speed of a political changeover, systematically overthrew the elected government. Historians call it the only successful coup d'etat of a local government in U.S. history. And it foreshadowed similar incidents in other cities in the years that followed. In Atlanta in 1906, in Tulsa in 1921, hundreds if not thousands of black people were killed after a black man was accused of sexually assaulting a white woman in an elevator. And an African-American town, Rosewood, Florida, was destroyed in 1923 after another claim of a black man assaulting a white woman. But among these violent events, the 1898 riot in Wilmington, North Carolina, stands out. This violence did not start because of a real or alleged criminal act, but because of a grab for political power. In 1898, the Wilmington riot is also the subject of a commission report released last week, and today we're taking a closer look at the events that occurred before, during, and after the riot, and how its legacy has affected the political and social life in the state of North Carolina. We welcome your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We're going to start the discussion with Tim Tyson. He's a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and a visiting professor of American Christianity and Southern Culture in the Divinity School there. Author of several books, including Blood Done Signed My Name, and co-author with David Soselsky of Democracy Betrayed, the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898, and its legacy. Tim Tyson, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you again.
How important is the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 in terms of North Carolina's history?
It's probably the most important political event in the history of the state, with the exception of the Civil War. It constitutes a major turning point. It was the consolidation, the creation and the consolidation of the Jim Crow South here in North Carolina. We grew up thinking that you had slavery first, and that was bad. And then you had segregation, you know, and that was bad, but it wasn't slavery. So, and it also shows an arc of progress. And then we got full citizenship for African Americans, you know, during the Civil Rights era. But in fact, that's not true at all. You know, we had a period of full citizenship for African Americans in North Carolina, and African American political influence and economic progress, also, a very significantly interracial political cooperation, and that ended in 1898 and set us on a different course that didn't change until the Civil Rights era. So it's a major watershed in the history of the state. The next 5 governors after the overthrow of the government in 1898 had all participated. It became the irreplaceable political credential for generations of North Carolina politicians, this loyalty to what Josephus Daniel called permanent good government by the party of the white man. So this was not an immutable racial order that was somehow stitched into the nature of things and an inevitable result of the African slave trade and slavery. Instead, it was the result of a white supremacist coup and revolution here in North Carolina, brought about intentionally with malice aforethought, ending interracial democracy, and performed by some of our most esteemed historic figures.
And it takes place fully 20 years after white Southerners regained control of the South.
Right.
But let's set the scene a little bit. Let's take a look at Wilmington, North Carolina, in 1898. Talk a little bit about its history. It was a thriving port city before the Civil War and was reconstructed fairly quickly after.
Yes, it had been the most important port in the Confederacy, most heavily defended port in the Confederacy anyway. And there's the saga of the blockade runners that young North Carolinians grew up on when I was coming up. But the people who had snuck ships in through the Union blockade into Wilmington, which was a very romantic story when I was in school, we didn't hear really about opposition to the Confederacy in North Carolina, which was widespread. And we didn't hear about this fusion coalition that had taken power in the 1890s in North Carolina and had both Senate seats and the governor's mansion and had captured the legislature and all of the all the statewide races. It was, they couldn't be beaten at the polls, and it was an interracial coalition, something that I found growing up here in the 1960s, I found unimaginable. I'd never heard of that. I didn't know that we had had this interracial political cooperation, not to say that there was some kind of utopia, and I didn't know that. And then, of course, in Wilmington, where I lived, actually one of the places we lived when I was growing up, we were there for 4 years, Wilmington had a very distinctive history. It had been the largest city in the state in 1898. It had a black majority. It was the seat of black political and economic power. There was a very substantial black business base. The only daily black newspaper in the United States was published in Wilmington. And this was really the stronghold of the Fusion Coalition, this remarkable experiment in interracial democracy.
Talk about this for just a minute, because it's somewhat different. After the Civil War, of course, getting the black vote was important to both, and the Republican Party had a lock on that, but it was done in a kind of a patronizing way. The idea was, you know, we'll speak for black voters and somehow try to get the vote. Fusion
right, that's
politics
why, that's
it,
why.
Is a little different. That involves cooperation, participation, and actually black elected officials.
Right, and it wasn't perfect. You know, what it was essentially many white farmers in North Carolina left the Democratic Party and became populist, forming the People's Party in 1892. And then this was, a dissident breakoff, mostly from the Democratic Party, but on the grounds of economics, because we had a huge agricultural depression all across the country, and the Democratic Party wasn't prepared to do anything about it. Actually, both major parties were at something of a loss. So there was this white agrarian movement, and they could not win without black support. They had excluded blacks from their ranks, but then they found common ground with black Republicans. So we had Republicans and populists against the all-white Democrats. There was a smattering of support, black support for the Democrats, but they basically became the party of white supremacy against the populists and the Republicans, who joined forces and agreed on slates of candidates and were called themselves the Fusionists.
So now here you are in Wilmington around 1898 with a successful coalition. Blacks and whites are fused in a political coalition, hold power. African Americans now have economic power as well. And here is where the white supremacists begin to make a stand. Tell us now about the events that led up to the riot.
Well, the nub of the matter was really the question of democracy, because the Fusionists wanted one man, one vote. Some of them even wanted women to be able to vote. It was a radical and crazy idea that women were also human beings, that many of the Fusionists believed. But so they had a much more democratic agenda. They also had this crazy idea, this harebrained scheme for free public schools that everybody would be allowed to go to.
Yeah, that could get you very far, yeah.
Yeah, that was a terrible, terrible idea, obviously. And they also wanted local control. The Democrats had wired it up so that local officials were appointed by the officials at the state level. They called themselves the Democratic Party, or they called themselves the Conservatives, the capital C, Conservatives, but they weren't very democratic, with a little d.
Mm-hmm.
And they had opposed this local control business, but the Fusion Coalition had a kind of a grassroots view of democracy and wanted people in their own communities to be able to choose their own officials. They also put together a lot of electoral reforms aimed at guaranteeing clean elections and making sure that everybody's vote would be counted.
So tell us what leads up to then the election of 1898.
So it became clear, well, first the Democrats ran this kind of race baiting campaign. They employed a group called the Red Shirts, which you might think of as sort of the Ku Klux Klan. They were mounted riders, terrorizing their political opponents and breaking up their rallies, and employed a strategy of demagoguery, using images of black men as sexual predators and brutes and beasts and such as that. Just this very, very stark, almost political pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And playing on stereotypes, and also shaming white men. The problem was that there was a substantial minority of whites who were willing to vote alongside blacks in North Carolina. Horror of horrors. And those people had to be peeled away. And what they did was just like what they tried to do in the 1960s, which was that when whites supported black aspirations and black equality, they said, you want your daughter to marry one then? You know, they tried to make black men out to be rapists and predators, and, you know, they're after your daughter, your mother. And if you are not willing to defend white womanhood, why you're not a man, you may not even be white. So they tried to shame people that way. That was somewhat successful, but not sufficiently. They had to rely on fraud, and then in the end, they had to essentially launch a coup. We had Charles Branly Acock, who would soon be governor, Furnifold Simmons, who would be in the United States Senate for the next six terms. We had Josephus Daniels, who was the publisher of the News and Observer and one of the most prominent Democrats nationally. They met down at the Chautauqua Hotel in New Bern and instituted a plan for these white supremacy campaigns that seized power.
And we will talk about the details of that coup d'etat, the riots that followed, and the way it changed politics in North Carolina as our conversation about the 1898 Wilmington race riot continues with your phone calls at 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the 30 years of Reconstruction following the Civil War, the city of Wilmington, North Carolina, grew into a diverse and prosperous city. According to one historian, Wilmington was a bustling, thriving port town at all levels of society and races during the last quarter of the 19th century. That cross-cultural prosperity ended in violence in November of 1898, when the Democratic Party coalition of white leaders and white supremacists took to the streets and attacked black people in Wilmington. The ensuing riot would become the only successful overthrow of a local government in American history. We're talking today about the 1898 Wilmington race riots, its legacy, with Tim Tyson, the author and historian who wrote, among other books, Democracy Betrayed, The Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and Its Legacy. It's a book he co-authored with David Ciesielski. And joining me now is Irving Joyner. He's a professor of law at North Carolina Central University. He's also co-chair of a commission that was assembled in the year 2000 by the North Carolina Assembly to look into the Wilmington Race Riot. And Irving Joyner, I want to welcome you to the program.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Talking to Tim Tyson about setting up the economic situation, the political circumstances in the Reconstruction period. This leads us to the election of 1898. Tell us about the actual riot and that election and what led to the violence.
Well, actually, the election was held on November 8th, 1898. That was the statewide campaign. Left in Wilmington, however, was still this fusionist government made up of the black Republicans and members of the fusionist party. There was a committee of nine, secret committee of nine, that basically organized and orchestrated those things that occurred in Wilmington under the direction and in cooperation with the Democratic Party. And on November the 9th, there was a meeting of what was called then the Committee of 25, which were leading whites in Wilmington, who put together a white Declaration of Independence, which was then presented to the city, and a demand directed toward the fusionist government to resign. There was then a meeting scheduled with the black leadership of Wilmington. They were called together and were presented with an ultimatum. Either you cease and desist your political activities, or something is going to occur. You have until tomorrow morning to do so. During the night, the committee, the black committee, a committee of colored citizens, as they called it, met and attempted to calm the situation. There was a response prepared, and that was given to one of the local attorneys, one of the black attorneys in town, who was to deliver that to the Committee of 25. That did not occur in terms of a personal delivery because there were sentry guards set up all over the town, and it was difficult for blacks to maneuver around the town. So the attorney put the response in the mail. Snail mail, even back then.
It wasn't even.
And of course, it was not received the next morning when the Committee of 25 met to determine what the response would be. This whole campaign was ignited, or they use as kind of cannon fodder, an editorial by Manley and the newspaper, the black newspaper in town, in which the issue of black male-white-female relationships were developed, were talked about, was discussed. And, you know, a lot of whites were angered at the editorial from Manley and his paper, and a lot of people wanted to get him out of town. So then there was a march then on the 10th, initially directed toward the newspaper to run Manley out of town. Manley had been warned that he was a target of this campaign, and he left town the night before. So when the mob got to the newspaper, Manley was not there. They then proceeded to break in, tear up the press, and actually burn the building down. And from there, a number of physical acts directed toward black shootings, which occur. And by our count, we're able to document the death of at least 60 African Americans during that time. The number of people actually killed is in dispute. But near the end of the day, slowly or one by one, members of the city council were marched in to a meeting with this Committee of 25 and individually forced to resign from office, surrounded by gun-toting white mobsters. They then independently resigned. Immediately after they were resigned, then somebody from the this Committee of 25 appointed someone to replace them in office. And by the
A list, I should point out, they had already made up.
Oh,
they
yeah.
already have this list of
right.
replacements.
Yeah. Right. So it was a process that they went through that was supposed to track the replacement process within the city charter in Wilmington at the time, except the replacements were supposed to occur by the then elected members of the city council. In this instance, it was the Committee of 25 that were actually appointing people to replace those persons who resigned.
So this is a coup d'etat. How does the state, Tim Tyson, react to this?
Well, that depends on who you regard as the state, doesn't it?
Let's start with the governor.
Well, this was, you know, the governor was greatly intimidated. He was nearly lynched during the election campaign. We should make There was an attempt to take him off a train and lynch him at one point. From the president on down, there's not forceful, president of the United States on down, there's not for any real opposition to this. That's really why it's an event that goes beyond North Carolina and its importance. It was a signal that it's open season on black citizenship, that there's no depredation so great that you will find that the federal government will do anything about it, that blacks literally have no rights. And it's kind of amending offenses between the North, the white North, and the white South. It's like the shaking hands about that little squabble about slavery that had gone on a half century before. You know, what you see is sort of white supremacy on the rise all over the country. Indeed, you know, an American empire emerging in Cuba and the Philippines,
and it's
certainly and the rise of quote scientific racism unquote.
Right. Effectively put an end to any of the possibility of the kind of fusion politics and populist politics that had gained a foothold in North Carolina and other places.
Right, and it even obliterates the memory of that. You know, all these Confederate monuments that go up across the region. If you look at the date, they all go up about 1910, 1912. And they're kind of commemorating what really hadn't been a unifying thing. White people were bitterly divided about the Confederacy and its legacy. You know, like all politics, there were people on both sides, lots of people. And here in North Carolina, thousands and thousands of people. And then we see this white supremacist social order nailed into place, and then this worship of the lost cause of the Confederacy that gets put in place, which is a new thing at the turn of the century. So it really, it not only changes history, you know, and has its own you know, political importance of changing the structure of power in North Carolina and across the country, but it also changes our memory so that when we really needed to cooperate in the 1950s and 60s, for example, there was no memory of the racial interracial cooperation that had gone on, which had been imperfect, of course, but would have been instructive. The white people in the civil rights era who wanted to stand with African Americans didn't realize that they had political ancestors, that they were standing actually in a tradition. And then of course the mistrust across racial lines, so that what could have been things could have been quite different. Where are the monuments to the fusion?
Let me ask Irvin Joyner, the co-chairman of a commission. It took over 100 years to resurrect the memory or reconstruct the memory of this. What do you think is the value of the? I want to ask you why it took so long. But is there a value in doing this now?
Oh yes. There's always a value in finding out the truth and presenting. The truth to prevent a misinterpretation of the history. There was a deep fear that developed in Wilmington after 1898. Black people were petrified. So they went into their own segregated communities and they began to develop a segregated economy, segregated lifestyle, segregated educational institutions. There was a fear, and there was a kind of a hush-hush secret that was whispered around in the community about remember what happened in 1898. Even as late as the 1970s, people in Wilmington were not talking about what happened in 1898. And you have to remember that from virtually 1898 up until the late 1970s, no black was elected to any position in the city or county, in the city of Wilmington or the county of New Hanover. And a lot of that was the fear. I know when I was there working on some of the Wilmington 10 situations, there was this kind of hush-hush, and then all of a sudden people would bring out crumpled copies of Leon Prather's book or Helen Edmonds' treatise talking about 1898, which piqued my curiosity because I had not heard about it before then. And then as we began to talk about now the cooperation between the Democratic Party, the News and Observer, and other institutions of note and distinctions in North Carolina that perpetuated, that organized, that instigated this overthrow was something that had to be told. So we had to get into this and find out more about it so that the public at large would know just what the state had and had not done with respect to efforts by blacks to become an integral part of the democratic process in North Carolina.
877-962-9862. If you want to join our conversation, taking a look back at the riot, the Wilmington riot of 1898. And we have a call from Clayton, and it's Reverend Anthony.
Yes, sir. I'm a historian, and I specialize in the Civil War period of history.
And I
want to say that that was the failure of the federal government and state government to do their responsibility to correct the situation. But I also want to decry black men of that period of time for being so cowards. They had fought in every war the U.S. had since its beginning, going back 300-400 years, yet they failed to stand up at that time.
You mean during in 1898?
Yes. There are other times when they failed to. They were good guys who fought in all the wars the U.S. have ever had, and many of them won many medals right up until recently, but that's about 12 different major wars going back to the 1600s, you know, the French and, you know, all the wars, 400 years. But then this was a time for them to stand up and fight back. They had enough men there in that town to fight back, and after the federal government, the state government, so they were fighting between them, they would have came in and tried to solve the situation, but they were cowards. They ran away.
Let's get a response. Irving Joyner?
Well, and clearly there were the numbers. There was not the firepower, and there was not the military organization that was present in the town among the African-American community. You know, when African-Americans came into power in Wilmington, they were under the impression that everything was all right, that they were now part of the mainstream and that they had control of the police department, they had control of the jails, they had controls of the organs of power, and they were exercising that. And when this coup d'etat occurred, it caught them without power, because whites had been stocking up with guns and superior firepower. So they were not able to respond. And then immediately it was a survival notion that people adopted. You know, how do we survive this? Because, you know, a number of people were run out of town. I mean, you had political leadership in the town that when they were pushed out of office, they were put on a train and shipped out of the city, and people were hiding out in the swamps, trying to escape the violence that occurred. So this violence was all inclusive, and it was just overwhelming, such that many of the people who wanted to respond, and some did respond, but it was ineffective against the military might that was perpetrated upon them. So it was not a matter of them running away or refusing. And I think, and we're talking about something that occurred not only in Wilmington, but throughout the South, throughout North Carolina. Tim Tyson can talk to you about the riots in Oxford, the riots in New Bern, and other places in North Carolina around the same time for pretty much the same purposes, except that the city government was not under the control of a fusionist government at that time. So it was not cowardness that prevented the African Americans from responding.
Tim Tyson, you also talked about the chilling effect this had on the political organization from that moment forward. And I want you to talk too about what this does to the idea of fatalism. There's a profound sense of fatalism. There's a quote in the report itself from a woman who tells her son that she feared that violence was coming. Quote, "We need it, and it must come, the violence, before things are settled." This idea of fatalism, that the two races are fated to live in enmity and fight, it seems to me, when you look at how well organized and how well orchestrated this particular event was, after 20 years of living together in integration, as you say, not perfect, what does it say about this notion of fatalism, that it has to be thus?
Well, I think people who wanted the violence and who wanted to seize political power tried to portray this as being somehow in the nature of things. And, of course, it is remarkable when you think about what the fusionists did. You're talking about the children of slaves and the children of slaveholders in the same political coalition, really in the shadow of slavery, just a few decades later. And the achievement that they made is really remarkable. You know, they're neck deep in white supremacy, the idea of black inferiority, which had been, you know, the rationale for the slave trade and for the social order of slavery. They're people of their time, and they have all the weaknesses of their time, but they have a kind of vision, and to call them cowards is outrageous. Because these are people of great vision who really risked everything for a new world and almost got it, you know. And it wasn't perfect. They were flawed people trapped in a tragic history just like us. But they did something remarkable, and we shouldn't ever forget it.
Let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Durham. Hello, John.
Hi there. I guess what we're essentially talking about is terrorism, and of course sometimes the tools of the terrorists and the anti-terrorists are hard to tell apart, but I thought the News and Observer article would have been more well-rounded if it had mentioned the owners of the News and Observer, the McClatchy newspaper founder, was extremely involved, heavily involved in the internment of Japanese during World War II, and of course that had a profound legacy that lasted for decades also, and I just felt it would have been made the article a lot
you're
better.
You're talking about the News and Observer article about the commission.
About the riots in Wilmington.
The recent article.
Right. And McClatchy, founder of McClatchy Newspapers, was the leading voice for causing the internment of Japanese, which of course was in itself a own form of terrorism against an entire race that lasted for decades.
Well, John, your question and observation leads to another set of observations, and I thank you for your call, regarding what we do next and whether or not reparations, which did happen in the case of Japanese internment, is something that's viable and recommended here. What are the recommendations? Those are some of the topics that we'll be pursuing as we continue our conversation about the Wilmington race riot of 1898. Irving Joyner, professor of law at NC Central University, co-chair of the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot Commission, is with us. Another member of the commission, Harper Peterson, will join us. Tim Tyson is the author, and he is with us as well. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Last week, the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot Commission released a 500-page report that looked at one of the most important, if least well-known, events in North Carolina history. Among other things, the report says the riot was not random violence or a lynching, but was directed by white businessmen and Democratic leaders to regain control of Wilmington. We're looking today at the legacy of the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot, as well as what actions the General Assembly might take when they consider the report early next year. We're joined by Tim Tyson, author and historian, who wrote, among other books, Democracy Betrayed, The Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and Its Legacy, which he co-authored with David Soselsky. Irving Joyner's with us, a professor of law at NC Central University and co-chair of the Wilmington Race Riot Commission. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. So we talked about, Irving Joyner, the power of the commission to bring this story to our consciousness. What do we do now? There have not been recommendations published. There will be. Any sense of what kind of recommendations we might see?
Well, our plan is to use the factual report to bounce off of African Americans in Wilmington and around the state what happened, and get recommendations and suggestions from them as to what our recommendations to the General Assembly ought to be. There are obviously some notions of things that can occur and that ought to be included, but we want to utilize this time frame from now until the beginning of May to solicit input from the community at large about what, and also to raise an awareness of what happened in Wilmington. So purposely, we decided that we would not present recommendations at this time until we were able to kind of survey the community about what appropriate recommendations would be.
Well, another member of the commission is Harper Peterson. He was the mayor of Wilmington from 2001 to 2003 and joins us now by phone from the city. Welcome, Harper Peterson.
Frank, hello. Professor Joyner.
Hello.
Mr. Tyson. I enjoyed listening to you.
It's often the case, Harper, that elected officials don't want to get involved in controversial issues. If you look at Greensboro, for example, mayor and the council members there don't want really any part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's dangerous politically. Why did you decide, and you've said this is very important to do. Why is that?
Well, I can look back to 1996 when only Representative Wright and myself were interested in the approaching centennial observation of 1898. Other elected officials locally and at the state level discredited or discarded or ignored what happened. I think that was representative of the last 100 years leading up to the centennial. Looking forward, now that we have this focused, factual, objective account, and I want to congratulate the state and the Department of Cultural Affairs and all the committee members, but obviously, especially Ms. Umfleet, because now we can have a discussion, we can have discourse and debate. And I think as a community, we can reach conclusions. It's not enough just to acknowledge what happened now that we have this great factual volume, but we do have to bring forward to make up for a segment of our population that has been crippled for 106 years. And I'm sure you've recounted the history post-1898 over the last half hour, but we're looking at the political reality, the economic, the cultural, the educational reality of the African-American community, not only in our city, the state, but nationally. And there's a direct correlation between what happened in 1898, center stage for the state, the nation, and the world. All eyes were on us, and we set a whole new course in American history, and in the process trampled the very principles and foundation of our country. So I'm excited about the opportunity, not only for black African-Americans to come forward with recommendations, but also the white community, and specifically the elected officials. It was interesting at our press conference last week, and Professor Joyner was present, that only one of seven elected officials were present from the
well,
city.
Let me ask you about that, because you were the mayor from 2001 to 2003, but have been defeated twice in mayoral elections since the commission was formed. Is there a connection here?
a positive connection. I felt very good about the votes that I received. My platform was very clear. It was inclusive, and I don't want to criticize or campaign on the radio, and I'm not looking back. I'm looking forward as a citizen, and I think we have to have dialogue, and again, we have to bring the black community forward. We have to catch up for 106 years of loss.
What is the sense, and give me a pulse of Wilmington as these commission proceedings were going on. Is there a sense, a strong sense, as there is in some parts of Greensboro, hey, look, let's just leave this alone. You're only going to create more trouble. A sense of relief that this is finally happening. What's the pulse in Wilmington?
Well, the sense I feel, both in the white-black community, is that now we have, again, a definitive account as the of what took place and what the results, the impact was on our community, city and state. So I think from here we can move forward. This is ongoing. We will make a report, present a report to the General Assembly in May, but I see this continuing because now we can truly look at how we can rectify, restitute the loss, the taking of 1898.
Professor Joyner, is it a definitive account in the sense that you as a commission had to come to some agreement? Was there difficulty coming to agreement on the facts as you pulled this together?
No. The facts were, yeah, and the amazing thing is that most of these facts are not controverted. Whites in Wilmington who disagree with the organization of this commission don't disagree with the facts. They just offer justification from their perspective for the overthrow. They don't call it a coup d'etat. They call it a little a skirmish in the street to remove corrupt officials from office. So, you know, so it wasn't difficult for us to agree on the facts, and we had an outstanding researcher that really went over and beyond to pull together the factual data that we've presented in the report. So there was not a dissenting voice to the factual presentation that we have here in the report.
Tim Tyson, why do you think it took so long for the state of North Carolina? These similar incidents, Rosewood, Tulsa, have been investigated in their respective states. Why has it taken North Carolina this much longer, do you think?
Well, I think it's at such a variance with North Carolina's image of itself, in truth. You know, there's this progressive mystique of North Carolina, as Bill Chafe calls it, that where and so the idea of a coup d'etat and massacre here, having installed this social order, is hard for people to get their heads around. It's a great piece of research, though. I just want to say, you know, Ms. Umfleet did a great job, and the commission, Professor Joyner, and Mayor Peterson and Representative Wright are really, and all the members of the commission are really to be congratulated for the fine thing they've done.
Well, is it enough at this point to know about what happened and to have all of the facts before us, or do there have to be some kind of does there have to be some kind of material exchange?
Some important things have to happen. For one thing, we have to recognize how deeply this history speaks to our future. It is time for a new fusion movement. Our racial situation at the moment is quite perilous. We've got and complicated. We've got this new Latino infusion and ongoing differences between black and white in economic development and in all areas of our public life. And we have to mend that, and we have to understand that this is less about what happened in 1898 than it is about the kind of communities we want our children and grandchildren to grow up in.
Professor Joyner, you talked about the fact that in 1898 African Americans felt like, okay, we've got it made, we figured this out, and we're now in power. Things are going just fine. Do you think that a sense of things being just fine is that we feel that today, and that may be an illusion?
Well, I think that now you have widespread participation by African Americans in the political life of North Carolina, in the economic, social, and educational life of North Carolina. Yet there are many people who are guarded and trying to see what efforts will be made to replicate the kinds of things that occurred during the first Reconstruction. I call this our second Reconstruction. And this second Reconstruction has lasted a little longer than did the first one, but yet they are troubling signs. As you look around, you see efforts afoot to undermine the ability of African Americans to freely participate in the franchise, in the elective franchise, in the economic franchise. And so people are watching that, and people are trying to organize efforts in the event that something happens, because it only takes a vote. It only takes a military presence that's alien to the interests of African Americans that can turn all of this around. So this is a fragile peace that we have right now, although a lot of African Americans have faith that things are better, that things are going to work out, and that, kind of like the African Americans in 1896 and 1898, that now we are part of this process. There is no way that it can be turned around, but it can be very easily.
But Tim Tyson, do you sense the kind of fatalism that was also present in 1898? The sense that we either have to let whatever injustices we're suffering go, or risk, violence, that either violence is inevitable or we just got to let it go and sweep it under the rug?
Well, what I see is a kind of fatalism around things like education. You know, I've been speaking at public schools all over the state, and haven't done a social science survey, but every time I'm go to a school and there's linoleum coming up off the floor and the locker doors are hanging off the lockers and there's the gym floor is rotted and there are broken windows, every time I'm in a school that looks like that, I'm looking at a sea of black and brown faces, black and Latino, vast majority in those kinds of schools. Every time I'm in a wonderful school that looks like Durham Academy, I'm looking at a sea of white faces. That's not an accident. We've got this large funding inequalities for public education, which, have to do with local schools on the one hand and our scheme for funding, but which do have racial implications because of the way we live. So we also have very uneven economic development in this state, with economic opportunities being focused in 8 or 10 of the counties in North Carolina. And if you look down in the Black Belt in eastern North Carolina, there's not a lot of hope down there, and we need to do something about that. So I don't think we can be complacent. There's also racial tension between black and Latino. We have a lot of issues between black and white communities in the state. So I think that it's a dangerous thing to pat ourselves on the back and say we've gone beyond this.
Harper Peterson, how do you see this playing out? Do you see the anxiety about the results and the outcome of this commission report creating more tension, or do you see greater resolution ahead? How do you see it?
I see illumination. So many, white and black, are unaware of these events and the impact on today's environment, community. Again, I will challenge elected leaders locally and at the state level and at the national level to acknowledge and respond in a meaningful way. I will use the word reparation and restitution, but looking forward for a community, to bring the community back, to make it whole again in economic areas, in religious, in educational, political, all of society. And it's time. After 106 years, it's time. And this is the challenge. Every generation has a challenge, and they must respond. For North Carolina, it will be restitution to the black community.
Irving Joyner is a professor of law and one who has observed the political scene in North Carolina. It's a challenge. Is it too challenging? Is this too difficult a challenge in this political climate now for politicians here to take this on?
No, it's a part of the struggle. African Americans have been involved in this repeatedly, over and over again. And what we're looking for is for a few strong people to stand up to champion the cause. I think that the African American community is dedicated to democratic society and participating in that process. And what we need would be, as Tim Tyson talks about, fusionists from the other side who are willing to join with us to make this a better world and a better state that we have. But it's a struggle, and it is a daunting one, but it's not one that is overwhelming or overpowering.
Tim Tyson, what are the obstacles, do you think, to that kind of coalition, that coalition that seems to make, a fusionist coalition that seems on one level to make so much sense?
Well, I think it's actually just a matter of ordinary sanity. People have to start recognizing that this is not about helping the downtrodden so much as it is what kind of place you want your children and grandchildren to grow up in. Do you want us to have a kind of Latin American social order with the mostly white-skinned aristocracy and their own private schools and their own private shopping areas and their own private security force and the mass of people, dark-skinned, outside, excluded from the goods and services of the society? Or do you want to have a thriving, you know, interracial, multicultural kind of place where everybody's welcome, where we have, you know, a wonderful public culture and strong schools for all our children, you know? So, we all breathe the same air, we all drink the same water, and when our public institutions fail, then it fails all of us, and I think it behooves everybody, all of us, black and white,
all right,
and red and brown, to be aware of this.
Tim Tyson, thank you very much for joining us. Tim Tyson is author and historian who wrote, among other books, Democracy Betrayed, The Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and Its Legacy, which he co-authored with David Ciesielski, as well as the book Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. Irving Joyner, thank you very much for being with us today.
Enjoyed it.
Professor of Law at NC Central University, co-chair of the 1898 Wilmington Race Riot Commission. That was formed in the year 2000. The recommendations will be out in May, we expect, of 2006. Harper Peterson, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you. Gentlemen, have a great day.
Harper Peterson is the former mayor of Wilmington and also a member of the commission. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment, you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.